Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and goes out noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. This week, the 10th anniversary of the London bombings. But what really happened that day? Do we know? Also, wild camping. Is it something you can still do? Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or see them online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. We start this week by looking at 7/7, and I'm going to hand over to Angela Balassi, who's going to be grilling me about it.
Yes, I'll be speaking to Tony, who worked on the IRA bombing campaign in the early 1990s for the BBC. Tony, firstly, what was that like?
Well, certainly, yes, it was for the BBC, not for the IRA. I was working on it. But it was, I suppose, fascinating, really, to be working in a busy newsroom in central London and to see the contrast between the way that different types of news stories got dealt with in our newsroom. So there was everything from a corporate press release, say a big company who's announcing something that day with a press conference, or even sending a spokesperson into the studios to say something which had really been pre-prepared by public relations team, to the really the bombing campaign was on the opposite end of the spectrum. So it was really completely unexpected, and a lot of resources in the newsroom had to be devoted to covering it. We had a because I was working at Greater London Radio in Marylebone High Street, all the BBC's local stations, and we were the local station for the whole of London, had this thing called, what we used to call, the voice of God in the ceiling. The first we knew about the bombings, for example, the Stock Exchange bomb that happened, I think it was 1990, a voice would come out of the ceiling, which was from the BBC's Broadcasting House Central newsroom, telling us that these sorts of things had happened. And so then what would happen is the news editor, James Cameron it was at the time, would assign reporters either sending some by motorbike sometimes, or by car, and also by tube, so that we get a range of different people to get to the scene first.
And can you draw any comparisons with the IRA bombings to that of 7/7?
Well, I felt, as someone who worked on these bombings in London, that the way it was reported was very different. We weren't getting a consistent story. Right from the word go, there were conflicting accounts, which I would suggest, you know, there has to be something behind that. I mean, the most important one was the very day of 7/7. We were told, for example, that Benjamin Netanyahu, who's now the Israeli Prime Minister, he was then the Finance Minister of Israel, was in London, and that everyone was very concerned because they knew that he was due to be at Liverpool Street at the same time as the Liverpool Street bomb went off. So quite rightly, the news wires in Israel particularly were phoning up the embassy in London saying, how is BB okay? Well, it turned out that, and this was reported at the time, that he got a warning not to leave his hotel that day, which is rather surprising, because it was supposed to be a surprise attack with the bombs all going off pretty much simultaneously at 9:30. Then there were conflicting accounts of what had happened. Some said he left the hotel and then he'd come back. Others said he never left the hotel. And so there were instantly conflicting accounts of events, which we never really got any of that in the IRA bombing campaign, certainly as far as I can remember. You know, one of the things, for example, with the Baltic Wharf bomb the IRA planted was really troubling, but that was actually coming out as part of the coverage. The troubling thing was that it looked as if the IRA cell had been under surveillance for weeks, and still MI5 allowed them to plant that bomb.
And why do you think that was?
I think it's difficult to know, but you know, you have to use guesswork, because the authorities won't tell you anything about the security services. I think probably it was because they need to justify their job, they need to justify their position, and if there ain't any bombs going off, then there's no need for an MI5.
Even at the expense of people's lives?
Well, in that case, there was only one person killed, because there was a warning, although there were lots and lots of windows shattered in Canary Wharf, Baltic Wharf. Only one person was killed, and that was, I think it was a Daily Express photographer who disobeyed police orders to come back, and he went right up to where the truck bomb was just taking a photograph when it exploded.
Okay, and going back to the 7/7, There have also been films made about this which haven't been shown. Why do you think that is?
Well, they haven't been shown on mainstream television, as far as I know, anywhere in the world, which is really surprising because some of them are very good. There's one called BT, and I've no idea why it's called that. I think it's just because this was the anonymous name of the person on the internet that made it. And this came out in about 7 different versions in the 3 or 4 weeks after the 7/7 bombings. And what this person had done, they just put together various bits of footage from news broadcasts and radio broadcasts mainly, also quotes from newspapers, which proved in many cases that what we were being told about the London bombings was just simply inconsistent. So, for example, they point out that Mark Honingsbaum, who was the Guardian's reporter, the very first report he did, lunchtime on the day of the London bombings, he was saying, and you can hear him on this documentary saying, Mark Honingsbaum, that the bombs were underneath the trains after having spoken to the people as they were coming out from the Edgware Road tube bombing. Also, other anomalies were that there's a chap called Daniel Obachiki who says he was on the bus, and he said that this guy, Hasib Hussein, who was supposed to be the bus bomber, simply wasn't on the bus. And he said there was a very suspicious guy who was acting suspiciously, who he said was saying left his rucksack upstairs on the bus, and this guy hopped off just before the bus exploded. He said he thought he was the bomber, and yet Daniel's story has really not been heard.
Why do you think that is?
Because I think sometimes the news media don't like to be labelled conspiracy theorists. They would much rather go along with the government narrative if the government and the police say this is what happened. Why should they question it? And I think this is a real problem with our modern media, is they don't actually question enough. But really the best, I think, of those various different documentaries which were made about 7/7 was called Ludicrous Diversion, and that refers to Tony Blair's statement saying that a public inquiry into the bombings would be a ludicrous diversion. Blair was saying we know what happened, so why would we have a public inquiry? He was ignoring the fact, of course, that this is what all of the victims' families, people who are injured in the blasts, were calling for. Ludicrous Diversion is a pretty good examination of some of the things that the government and the police have told us happened that day that simply don't add up.
And there were 52 people who were killed and 770 who were injured. Do you think the victims, their families, have been heard?
Well, they have, but only just. And in fact, even more recently, it came out that some of the victims' families had their phone hacked by the News of the World, which is really an appalling thing to do for someone who's lost their kids. They then find that not only that, but the Murdoch Press is trying to steal information from them, hack their phones. It really just adds insult to injury. But the main problem has been that many of the main questions that the families have asked, that is to say, the security services said that the four bombers were clean skins. They said they had no record of them, and it's later transpired in court cases, in trials, that actually they had very big files on at least 3 of the 4 bombers. The families want to know why nothing was done, even though the security services had been following these people around all over the world, some of them, and keeping a very, very close eye on them. So why was the surveillance not completed? Also, the families were not allowed to ask questions at the inquest. There was an inquest into those 52 deaths, which is a strange thing to do. Actually, it should have been a public inquiry if there's a large number of people dying, but an inquest is designed really just for one individual death. And so the families are really not satisfied with that, and to this day they're still calling not for a public inquiry anymore, but an independent inquiry like the Hillsborough inquiry, because they still don't feel that their questions have been answered. And this is just a quote, one of the family members feels stonewalled by the government.
And this stonewalling, who does this benefit?
Well, difficult to know, but it seems that there are people. I mean, I think he lost his 22-year-old son in the bombings. One of the things he said is that they have clear evidence that that people in the security services knew about these guys and had them under surveillance in the weeks running up, and yet nothing has changed. So the systems that led to the London bombings taking place are still in place. What that suggests is that something else, exactly the same, could happen again, and the same mistakes be made all over again. And I think they're absolutely right to be calling for a proper independent inquiry along the lines of Hillsborough, which effectively means it be led by the families rather than by the government.
So I suppose arguably somebody could be under surveillance, but that doesn't mean it will amount to anything.
Well, I think they want to know where the security services have fallen down. I mean, just to go back to the Lee Rigby killing 2 years ago in Woolwich, for example, the security services actually had the two killers sprung from jail in Africa and brought to Britain. And then they carried out this attack. So you do have to wonder what the security services are up to, because what the main problem here is people who have been responsible for these acts which have led to terror attacks and innocent people dying here in Britain have never been called to account.
What lessons do you think can be learned from 7/7?
I think mainly don't allow privatisation of the tube. This is another aspect to it all, is that contracts were let out just about 5 months, I think, before the London bombings. And there are suspicions about the companies that had access to the tube tunnels beforehand. So most people travelling on the London Underground don't realise that parts of it have been privatised.
So do you think somebody's benefiting financially potentially from
Well, the main benefit seems to me to be to the, first of all, to those that want to take away civil liberties here in Britain, and also those that want to pursue wars abroad.
Okay, thank you, Tony.
Thanks, Angela.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, the book's called Angela Remembered, The Life of Angela Gradwell Tuckett, by Rosie McGregor. It's just out in paperback, price £7.50, and I'm joined on the line by the author Rosie McGregor, who's also the chair of Southwest TUC now. Hi Rosie, welcome to
Hi,
Dialect.
Lovely to talk to you.
Tell us first of all, before we start looking at Angela Remembered, about the Southwest TUC. What's your role there?
I'm the chair, so that means I sort of chair meetings. I work very closely with Nigel Costley, who's the secretary, and we have regular meetings of representatives from all the trade unions that are members of the TUC in the South West.
There's so much unemployment now, though. Surely the trade union movement really is a kind of lost cause.
Not at all. And in fact, I think with austerity and the current government, we actually are necessary perhaps more than ever we have been in the past, or certainly in the recent past.
So why remember Angela?
A few years ago, some friends of mine in Swindon, Ted and Ivy Poole, were talking about Angela. Although she was born in Bristol, she spent the years towards the end of her life in Swindon. And just a passing comment came from Ted Poole that it was a pity that no one had ever really written very much about her life. So I decided I'd do it. A sort of, I was going to say as a labour of love, but more as a labour of respect, I would say.
I noticed that Angela actually went to fight in the Spanish Civil War. Was that quite a peculiar thing to do in the 1930s?
Yes, but actually she didn't actually go and fight. That was one of the legends that grew up about Angela, was that she went off to fight in the Spanish Civil War.
So part of the book is actually putting the record straight on these things.
Putting the record straight. She did actually do a huge amount of fundraising, and she actually visited Guernica, that was very, very heavily bombed after the bombing, to see what it was like. But she produced a lot of propaganda. I suppose that was when she first realised she had a talent as a journalist. But for 2 years during the Spanish Civil War, she was living in the United States.
Well, she was born in Bristol, but what was her connection with the city?
Well, she was born in Bristol. She was born in a large house on the Downs. She was born into a very affluent but very artistic family. Her father was a renowned local solicitor, and Angela followed him into the legal profession, and in fact she was the first woman to qualify as a solicitor in Bristol.
Now I notice she's also connected with the Tuckett's buildings at the junction of Stokescroft and Cheltenham Road, which are now sort of part of, I suppose you could call it a sort of trendy quarter, the political quarter, the Stokescroft area of Bristol.
That's right. Now her grandfather and his father were tea merchants. They'd originally come from Cornwall, the family, and there were two main branches of the family, the Tuckett's, who were based in Bristol, and the Tuckett's, who were based in Frenchay. And they were Quaker families, but they were also abolitionists about slavery. But the Tuckett's in Stokescroft were also tea merchants. and not slavers, which is really important, I think. And they had a grocery store in three buildings, still known as Tuckett's Buildings, at the junction of Stokescroft with City Road.
Now, you describe one of the chapters, Militancy, Marriage and Marxism. In what way was she a militant?
Well, now that was really interesting. Her family were left-wing, and her Aunt Edith was a very early trade unionist and feminist. She was one of the founding members of the Gas Workers Union. And Angela was brought up in this environment. In 1931, she went down to Old Market to see the hunger marches coming from South Wales. And she was involved in the riots that took place there. She wasn't personally part of it, she just happened to be there. And seeing the plight of the hunger marches, she made a decision that she would join the Communist Party. So she did. And she remained loyal to the cause right up until her death.
Now, this Wal Hannington and the unemployed movement, it was a whole kind of massive thing going on in the 1930s, which we largely forgotten about. What was the roots of it and how did it manifest itself?
I don't actually know the roots of it, other than the fact that there was a huge level of unemployment. The unemployed workers were forming together into various unions of unemployed workers.
Well, that's interesting, because unemployed people definitely don't nowadays do that sort of thing. I mean, this seems, I think, to have had something to do with the Wall Street crash of 1929.
It did. That was really one of the main triggers, because the Wall Street crash had this huge knock-on impact on the whole world, and much like the bankers happened in recent times. It had a huge impact, and a lot of the companies providing employment in the UK suddenly found they hadn't got any financial backing anymore. The owners had lost all their money in the crash, and people were being laid off. And, of course, around the world, people didn't need the goods that we were manufacturing here. So, again, that was another reason why people were being laid off. And when you've got a lot of people who are unemployed, living really in poverty and destitution, I think they saw it as a means of fighting and bringing their cause to those of the community who were better off.
So the hunger marches, I mean, that's what apparently sparked the riot. Angela then joined the Communist Party. Well, why was that, do you think? What did the Communists have to offer?
I think Angela, she was an idealist. Certainly when I knew her, she was very much an idealist. She was also a romantic. And I think she regarded the communist cause as the fairest way of gaining equality for everyone. Of course, that didn't really happen ultimately, but I think she always felt that she wanted a better world, and that, I think, for her, was the only route towards a better and fairer society.
Now, a lot of people point, don't they, at the Soviet Union and Communist China, saying, well, actually, what you got there was something just as bad, really, a kind of a system which was very much top-down, where also, although peasants and things were given land, they didn't necessarily know how to use it, and the system wasn't working very well. Then there's also the interventions in Eastern Europe, the so-called tankies, you know, people who are supporting Moscow intervening in those countries when the people, it seemed, wanted to shake off Moscow as their as their ruling. So where did Angela stand on that?
She really had this romanticized view that communism would win the day in the end. But I don't think what you're describing, you know, the Stalinism, Mao, I don't think she saw that as communism, because it wasn't. In a way, it was fascism. It was about leaders who were gaining power, and it was abusive power. And that was not the communism that Angela saw as helping to bring a fairer and more democratic world.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because people can get very, particularly on the left, can get very aerated about this sort of thing. But anyway, I know she was also involved in something called Bristol Unity Players during World War II, which was a fascinating group that were doing theatre here in Bristol, which is now sadly lacking. I mean, there's not really much in the way of places, particularly where amateur groups can perform in the city now. But what was the Unity Players? What were they doing in the war?
Right, well, they were a really proactive group of people. Mainly, they were amateur actors, although there were some professional actors involved. And Angela's sister Joan was one of the members of the League of Progressive Writers. She'd also trained at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and she was a professional actor, having appeared, actually, in some George Bernard Shaw plays in London. She was one of the stalwarts of the Bristol Unity Players, and she produced and co-wrote a number of plays between 1935 and 1947. They were very left-wing socialist plays with names like The Bull See Red, which was about the Spanish Civil War, Smash and Grab, Charity Begins were some of the names of some of the plays that were produced. And they had masses of people would go along to see the plays performed in places like Queen Square and up on the Downs. Regularly, Queen Square would be packed by Bristolians going to see the Unity Players performing.
Oh, that's right. I mean, the pictures, one of the pictures in your book, Angela Remembered, it's got, it looks like the War Memorial right in the city centre and a play taking place right next to it with, it looks like, hundreds of people watching it.
Yes. They built scaffolding stages around things like the War Memorial and then performed to masses of appreciative audiences. That they were performing against all sorts of things about capitalism, about the impact on conscientious objectors who were forced to go into prison or into hiding during the war, plays about Hitler, and the need for the war effort. They were quite amazing, the things that they did, and they were very highly regarded. Sadly, Joan, her sister, became an invalid soon after the war, and I think after the war, you know, we were rebuilding the country, and sadly, audiences began to drop off, and I don't think there were that many people who were still around who were able to sort of produce these plays. So by 1945, 46, 47, it had all ended, sadly.
Also, one of your chapters is called Memories of Folk Song and Revolution. So was that connected with the plays and music from the plays, or was that something that Angela got involved with separately?
That was something that she got involved with separately, although there was always music with the plays. And Angela was a concertina player. She played in concertina orchestras, of which there were many across the country, but notably in Bristol and in London in the 1940s. And she was a great authority on English traditional folk song. Her father and her grandfather and members of her family knew people in their day like Cecil Sharp, who collected English folk songs. And she became quite an authority on traditional ballads. She sang them, often quite long ballads. It was an acquired taste, I have to say, Angela's playing and singing.
But she then you say moved to Swindon. So yes. What was she doing there?
Right. Well, she married a university professor from Bristol University in the 1930s, and for a short time she lived in the States. She felt he'd betrayed her because he was having affairs with various other people. I think he saw it as an open marriage and she didn't. And so she left him. She came back to England and she settled in London for a time, and she was the first solicitor to work for the National Council for Civil Liberties, which of course today is still going and is known as Liberty. So she was their legal advisor during the war. And then after that, she was recruited to work as the legal advisor for the Daily Worker, which of course was the forerunner of the newspaper The Morning Star of today. so she was their legal advisor, and she had this talent for writing, so she became a journalist.
Well, I think you've done a very good job of summing up her life, and in the book too, but tell us a little bit about the character of Angela, Rosie.
She was a really interesting person. She had opinions about most things. She was incredibly athletic and alert. She played hockey for England. She played in 11 women's hockey internationals during her lifetime. And in fact, she fell out with the English hockey people when she refused to give the Nazi salute in Berlin in an international hockey game against Germany in 1935. She was still, when she was in her 70s and 80s, she once told me that she could still do cartwheels and the splits. And I never saw her do it, but she was very tall, she was very angular, very slim, very healthy. So that in itself, I think was incredible. But she also was very caring, and she had a great sense of humour, which perhaps in retrospect I haven't brought out enough in the book, because I had one person say to me, oh, she must have been a very serious person. And I said, well, she took life very seriously, but she had a fantastic sense of humour.
Well, well done, Angela, for not giving the Nazi salute at the Olympics.
Absolutely,
in Berlin.
Yes.
And thanks very much, Rosie McGregor, for telling us about her.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for listening.
And the book's called Angela Remembered, The Life of Angela Gradwell Tuckett by Rosie McGregor, priced £7.50. Published by Watermarks and White Horse in Wiltshire. Also hailing from Swindon and actually working on Angela Remembered book is Bob Naylor, the singer. And now we're going to hear a song from him, Farewell to the Life of the Rover.
The old ways are going, you cannot deny, the day of the traveller's over. There's nowhere to go, there's nowhere to be, so farewell to the life of the rover. Goodbye to the tent and the old caravan, to the tinker, the gypsy, the travelling man. Goodbye to the 30-foot trailer. Farewell to the cans and the travelling tongue. Goodbye to the Romany talking, the buying and selling, the old fortune telling, knock on the door and the hawking. Goodbye to the tent and the old caravan, to the tinker, the gypsy, the travelling man. Goodbye to the 30-foot trailer. You've got to move fast to keep up with the times, for these days a man cannot linger. There's a bylaw to say you must be on your way, and another that says you can't wander. Goodbye to the tent and the old caravan, to the tinker, the gypsy, the travelling man. Goodbye to the 30-foot trailer. Farewell to the besoms of heather and broom. Farewell to the creel and the basket. The folks of today, they would far sooner pay for a thing that's been made out of plastic. Goodbye to the tent and the old caravan, to the tinker, the gypsy, the travelling man, and goodbye to the 30-foot trailer. Farewell to the pony, the cob and the mare, the reins and the harness are idle. You don't need the strap when you're breaking up scrap, so farewell to the bit and the bridle. Goodbye to the tent and the old caravan, to the tinker, the gypsy, the travelling man. Goodbye to the 30-foot trailer. Farewell to the fields where we
we've sweated and toiled at ploughing and hoeing and lifting. They'll soon have machines and those travelling queens, and their menfolk had better be shifting. Goodbye to the tent and the old caravan, to the tinker, the gypsy, the travelling man, and goodbye to the
That was Farewell to the Life of the Rover, sung by Bob Naylor.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Stephen Neal, an award-winning journalist and author, will be talking to us about people's rights to wild camp in the UK and Republic of Ireland's most secluded places. In his book, Wild Camping, Stephen reveals how the right to sleep outdoors has been whittled away hundreds of years ago. But we have more rights than most people realise to camp outside in the wild. Hello, Stephen. Thank you for joining us.
Hello.
Firstly, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I noticed on forums, on the internet in particular, that people were frequently asking, you know, where can I go wild camping? Where can I go and sleep in the woods? And it was common for... Because they were commonly told, you know, you mustn't ask questions like this. It's illegal. We'll have to close we'll have to close down the thread if you continue to ask these sort of questions. That was worst case scenario. Sometimes it would be, we'll have to private message you, and it all just seemed. I thought it was rather sad that people thought that it's illegal and that you're committing a criminal offence. Just. By doing something actually that's a wonderful thing to do, and it's not a criminal offence.
So why do you think it's important that we should be able to camp outside, wild camp?
Well, probably the most important thing about sleeping out is it's about as close to nature as you can get, you know. I don't think there's any of us that don't go walking in the countryside or cycling or even, you know, boating, but certainly all of us go walking in the countryside. But there is something wholly different in going for a walk in the countryside and you just keep on walking as the sun falls, and then when nighttime comes, you actually sleep in the outdoors, not in your garden, not on a campsite enclosed by fences and hedges and things, but you actually sleep in the outdoors in an unenclosed space, and there's something almost indescribable about that. But it's the best way to describe it really is that you are totally at one with nature. Waking up in the morning is a beautiful feeling.
And so where can we camp in the wild?
Well, in the UK and Ireland we can camp pretty much. Well, I wouldn't say anywhere. You can't camp anywhere. We have legal rights to camp in Scotland. It's a right enshrined in law. We have a right enshrined in law to camp on Dartmoor, most of Dartmoor. There are other places in the UK where we have rights to camp, but just because we don't have the right to camp doesn't mean we can't camp. So there are just an unlimited amount of places that we can camp legally. And that would include woodland, rivers, tidal estuaries, tidal coast, mountains. It's just the list is endless.
And when would we be breaking the law if we camped in the wild?
Well, when we would be crossing the line, and we may be breaking the law, or we certainly would be breaking the law, is if a landowner approaches us. So say for instance we were on the Pennine Way, for instance, we may be up relatively high in the hills. If a landowner came along and said to us, look, excuse me, but I would prefer you not sleep there. You're in your bivy bag. Can you please move on? The moment we start to engage in a dispute and start to argue, that's when we may be causing a breach of the peace. if we caused any criminal damage, if we were lighting a fire, that could constitute criminal damage. So there are all sorts of occasions when we could be breaking the law, but the simple act of sleeping is rarely, very rarely will we be breaking the law, constitute a criminal offence. But the rule is, if you're asked to move on, I've only ever been asked to move on once, and I'm 51, but if you are asked to move on, then just move on, or perhaps offer the landowner, just offer him some token payment, he or she, and that's often, or if, you know, that's often accepted. But so those are the occasions when we may be breaking the law.
If you're woken up in your tent in the middle of the night, could you do anything about it if they decided to ask you to move
on? Yeah, absolutely, yes. I mean, you see, part of the reason why people ask us to move on is they're confused as to why we're there. So, an example I could give you is if you set up a tent in the high street, which wouldn't be an example of wild camping, but if you set up a tent in the high street, then a police officer may come up and say, excuse me, what are you doing? And if you just said, well, I'm just sleeping, you know, what's the problem? The police officer will probably say, well, sorry, but can you move on? As opposed to if you were sleeping outside a shop, police officer says, why are you doing that? Why are you sleeping? And you say, well, actually, I'm waiting for the shop to open in the morning because they've got a sale on. The police officer will likely say, oh, okay, that's fine. If you have any problems, I'm down the road. So a lot of the misconception about wild camping is to do with people don't always understand. So if you do get woken up in the night by a landowner, what are you doing? Oh, I'm on my way to, the next town. I'm on a 2-3 day hike. If you explain that to the landowner, you're not causing any trouble, you're not a criminal, you have no intention of lighting a fire, and actually, look, I've got a bag here, I've been picking litter up on the way, they are almost always very, very happy for you to be there, as long as they understand why you're there. I mean, I used to get woken up a lot just sleeping in cars and things. You know, it's just landowners just want to know why you're there, what you're doing. As long as once they realise you're not a criminal, then no problem. But if they do ask you to move, you must move. You must move on.
But at the same time, our rights to camp have been whittled away, as you say in your book, Wild Camping. Why do you think that is, and how has it happened?
Our rights were mostly removed around about 1,000 years ago, Norman invasion post 1066. Before that, you know, it was commonplace that the majority of us lived, we didn't live wild, but we lived off the land. We collected firewood from the forest, we hunted, we had certain rights over the land, and post 1066, a lot of those rights were removed. It's one of the reasons the Magna Carta was the introduction of the Magna Carta. But the right to fish, the right to collect wood, the right to camp, so many of those rights were removed, and it was a way of the Normans, the new elites, of asserting themselves over the land, and that was part of it. And so some of the, you know, there are some anomalies that still exist, like, for instance, we haven't got a right in this country to fish on non-tidal waters. You know, that's an anomaly. We think it's normal, but it isn't normal. People living in other countries don't consider that normal. In many other countries, it isn't normal to not be able to camp in the wild. As it is in Scotland, it's a right in Scotland. It isn't a right in most of England.
Is there anywhere else, any other countries where it's guaranteed by law?
Yes, it's enshrined in law in Scandinavia. There are many countries where it's a right. There are many countries it isn't a right, but it's accepted. You know, it's generally accepted. I would say it's less accepted here than many other countries. When I was in my early 20s, I backpacked. I spent 5 or 6 or 7 years backpacking. Never ever had a problem. Never experienced any problem with anybody asking me to move on. It was just accepted. You know, sleeping in the woods or backpacking in the woods on the beaches, it wasn't a problem, but it can be more of a problem in the UK. So even though it's not a right in all the countries of the world, it isn't frowned upon as much as it can be in the UK.
Why do you think that is?
Well, again, I think it's a legacy of the law changes. You know, forest law, the forest laws that were introduced by the Normans. You know, it's where the stories of the Robin Hood type characters living in the forest, living off the land. You know, the forest laws were brutal. Anyone caught hunting or fishing, you'd have your limbs removed, your hands cut off, your head cut off. You know, potentially. People were executed for breaking the forest laws. Most of Essex was under forest law. Almost all of Essex was under forest law. And, you know, it's a legacy of those old forest laws. In many other countries around the world, fishing is a good example. As I say, we consider it completely normal for somebody to go fishing in the sea and to catch a mackerel or a cod and to take that home. We consider it almost offensive for somebody to for people to go fishing in a non-tidal river or a lake and then to take the fish home. It's not considered a problem, and that's all the legacy of the old forest laws.
In your book Wild Camping, you refer a lot to the law. I take it this must have taken, was it years of research, or did you also have guidance?
Well, I did have, I mean, you know, part of my part of putting the book together was looking at the laws, to a close examination of the law, the difference in civil law, criminal law. Trespass is a civil law rather than criminal, but I was able to contact a law firm. I know a local law firm, Kersey's, and I spoke to one of the partners there, Anthony Wooding, and he was able to give me some fantastic advice, tell me when I was maybe pushing it too far, and he's massively helpful in helping me understand the differences in criminal and civil law and explaining how to stay within the law.
And where can people find out more?
The book came out a couple of weeks ago in May. All they need to do is put Wild Camping into Amazon. Wild Camping, Sleeping in the Wild in the UK and Ireland, and published by Bloomsbury.
Thank you, Stephen Neil.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
We've just had a general election, with quite a split actually between Scotland and England. In fact, there's been a landslide for the Scottish National Party and the Labour Party. Many people are saying that they should learn a few lessons from the Scots. Actually, the Scots in many ways seem more politically astute than the English. I'm joined on the line by William Todd. He's from Stirling. William, you're a watcher of politics. Why is it that you got in touch with this programme?
Well, it's something I believed. That it was an English lady that told me about this a couple of years ago, that the Conservatives, if they win the election in 2015, intend to bring in a property vote.
Now, what is a property vote? Because I thought we had universal suffrage, even though there's quite a lot of people who have slipped off or never were on the electoral register.
Yeah, about 200 years ago, 1832, the Liberals finally got the property vote on the democratic ladder. And that means that the people that had £10 in property, or say up to £50 in the bank, they got the property vote. Prior to that, for years, there were discontent and riots right throughout the English cities. Bristol was one of the worst.
No, oh, that's interesting, isn't it? But Bristol had riots. What were they all around? So there was people that didn't have the vote.
The people there did not have the vote. It was just a few thousand people, like the Duke of Wellington, that had the vote. Right? And the Tories opposed ordinary people that had property having the vote, because that was giving power away to the mass.
So surely, that's long ago banished. That can't possibly come back.
Well, could I go back to the 80s when Mrs. Thatcher brought in the poll tax? That goes back to the 13th and the 17th century. The Conservatives, that's where they are. That's always where they are, in the past, taking power from the poorest people. So, in my opinion, and I'm firmly of the convinced, once the Conservatives remove the Human Rights Act, they intend to bring in a property vote. I don't know what the financial bar would be, maybe 1,000, maybe 2,000. And it comes down to this. I mean, anybody that's looked at the documentaries on television, there was one on there a few months ago with this lady, and the horrors that woman went through to get the vote without a property qualification. So, I mean, it's just 1918 since the working class actually got the vote. It's less than 100 years ago. You know, it's not a long time.
Now, you mentioned the poll tax there. Of course, there was an original poll tax back in the 1300s, but the poll tax riots, what was called, there's a very good film about them actually, called The Battle of Trafalgar, which was shown on Channel 4. But this was really about a swapping over, wasn't it, for the individual local council taxes from the property owner to, and in fact it was a victory really for the Thatcher government, because there wasn't a lot of difference between the poll tax and what we now have as the council tax.
Well, again, it's about power and defranchising people. When they brought the Conservatives brought the poll tax, then they knew that many thousands, hundreds of thousands, would leave the electoral registrar, and that's what happened en masse in Scotland and right through England. So they knew that people that would never vote for them just did not register to vote, and that's what's going to happen now. You know, it's really that serious. Last year I wrote 400 letters to the House of Commons on this issue, and 300 letters throughout the UK and the world to bring recognition to what's going on behind their backs. This year, on the 5th of May, I wrote to the 792 House of Lords, and I've got a really good response back, in particular from the Bishop in Bristol. That's a man called Mike Hill, Right Reverend Mike Hill, Bishop of Britain, and he opposes the bedroom tax, and it was first brought to the House of Lords and will continue to do so, and it seems a very inconsistent and punitive way of raising taxes. Now, there's people like that, Rowan Williams, he agrees with me completely, and he's very, very concerned.
Well, you've had quite a good response from some people.
Oh, crap,
but
the bishops in England are wonderful, you know.
But
one from the Diocese of Birmingham, again, concerned, and they're looking at this in the House of Lords when they bring it up. And there's another one from the Bishop of Coventry. Again, Bishop Christopher has asked to thank you for writing him, expressing your concerns, which is noted.
Now, one of the things that happens, doesn't it, when you have taxes based on if the local authority knows that you're there, is that people do not vote. So is this what you're saying, is that there is actually some sort of concerted effort, and that might be formalised in the future to try and make sure that people that don't own property don't have the vote?
I honestly believe, and this is my, I believe they're going to bring back the property vote. Now, I've had a massive correspondence, and I know my letters have been published throughout the UK and the world, and on the radio programmes. I mean, there's many people that are listening in Bristol. They know an awful lot more than me. I mean, they had the riots there 200 years ago, and that was because the great mass of people did not have the vote. And I think we've got to remember this. It's only 1928, without a property qualification, the women of Britain and Northern Ireland got the vote. You know, I mean,
now, you talk about the old Etonians. Why do you bring them in?
Well, my intelligence is part of the oldest Etonian group have got this plot, and they intend to carry it out, and I have no any doubts they will carry it out. First, they must remove the Human Rights Act. Once that goes, and that will go for the next couple of years.
Now, I know one of your favourite books is this book, Perilous Questions, by Antonia Fraser. What is it you like about Antonia Fraser's book, Perilous Questions?
I mean, I've read a number of books on the Perilous Question. That is the 1832, the Great Reform Act. And she's brought it to the attention of people, the way I've read the book and interpreted it, that it can happen again, just as the poll tax came back from the 13th century. And Bristol is one of the places I concentrated in my letters to the media, like yourself, and the newspapers, because I know Bristol, the people of Bristol are strong people, as I've shown over the hundreds of years. very strong condition, naval and so on.
No, I know. I mean, you're giving everyone a bit of a warning about this. Can I ask you how much can you tell us about what intelligence you've gathered and who from and how you why you believe this so strongly?
Well, last year I got a letter back from Heather Wheeler from South Derbyshire. That's a Conservative candidate. That's a Conservative MP. And the last part of her letter is, she says, "Rest assured, I have responded to all Southern Derbyshire constituents and have contacted me on this issue raised. People are concerned throughout England, Scotland and Northern Ireland and Wales, and are the right to be concerned. We have a ruthless right-wing government in power just now, mostly voted for in the southeast of England, as I see it, and they're only, 37% have voted for them, and they can, with this majority of 12, they can push through any legislation they want, and they will."
Now, we also share an interest, don't we, William, with Brian Garfield and a book called The Paladin.
Well, it's a
different subject. Can you just tell us a bit about that book and why that novel you like so much?
Well, the chap, and it's a novel, but it's based on a real Englishman. He was a naval officer, and he was one of the 12 knight-errants Churchill had, basically assassins.
Effectively, you're saying that there's there's also, I mean, just as there was in the Second World War, a tiny cabal, there's a similar kind of thing going on today, are you?
Yeah, and the House of Commons, yeah, and right throughout the system, that's what I understand. A few years ago, a lady, an English lady I worked for and was friendly, I used to meet her at the Smith's Institute in Stirling, which is a cultural organisation run by Elspeth King, that's the director. And I met this old English lady and she told me, "William," she says, "there is going to be a property vote." She had property in London and property up here. And I says, "I don't know very much about it, but," I says, "they cannot do that." And she says, "Yes, they can. If they get a majority in 2015, and I believe they will carry it out. The Tories are like that. They're quite ruthless." And I read up in that for 6 months, and then I heard this top Liberal speak in the Glasgow conference there about a year or two ago, and he brought up that 1832 Act, and I says, "Goodness sake, this really is." Anyway, I believe it now. When I read Perilous Questions, which is the best book that I've read on the 1832 Reform Act, the Great Reform Act, and I've read Churchill's English speaking people on this, and I really believe they're going to do this. And I think the Holy Britain and England was a thank you to the lovely Antonia Fraser. She's a wonderful person.
Okay, William Todd, thanks very much for joining us from Stirling. Thank you. That's all for this week. Dialects, Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, William Todd, the Wild Camper, Stephen Neal and Rosie McGregor. And to studio engineer, Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
It fell about the Martinmas time, the snow lay over the border. There came a troop of soldiers here to take up their winter quarters. With me right far-ly the deedle-ly the doddy-o, with me right far-ly the deedle-ory. Well, they rode up and they rode down and they rode over the border. And there they met a fair pretty maiden, she was the farmer's daughter. With me
me right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ory. Well, they made her swear a solemn oath, with a salt tear in her eye, oh, that she would go to the quarter gates when no one would espy, oh. With me right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ory. So she has gone to her father's house, and she's dressed in soldier's clothes, oh. A brace of fine pistols are down by her side, and a nice little boy was she, oh. With me right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy, oh. With me right far lie the deedle, ory. Then she has gone to the barber shop, to the barber shop when she, oh, she's made him cut a fine yellow hair, just as short as any dragoon, oh. With me right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy, oh, with me right far lie the deedle, ory. Then she has gone to the quarter gate, and loudly she did call, oh, room, room, ye gentlemen, we must have lodgings all, oh. With me right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy, oh, with me right far lie the deedle, ory. Well, the quartermaster, he came out, he gave her half a crown, oh, saying, go and find lodgings for your men, for here there is no room, oh. With me right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy, oh, with me right far lie the deedle, ory. So she's gone nearer to the gates, louder she did call, oh, room, room, ye gentlemen, we must have lodgings all, oh. With me right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy, oh, with me right far lie the deedle, ory. Well, the quartermaster, a cane came out, he gave her 18 pence, so, saying, go and find lodgings for yourself, for tonight there comes a wench, oh. With me right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy, oh, with me right far lie the deedle, ory. So she's taken the cap from off of her head, the ribbon from her hair, oh. She's tied them to the quarter gates as a token that she was there, oh. With me right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy, oh. With me right far lie the deedle, ory. And she's taken the whistle from off of her belt, loudly she blew shrill, oh, saying you're all very free with your 18 pence, but you're not for a girl at all, oh. With me right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy, oh, with me right far lie the deedle, ory. With me right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy, oh, with me right far lie the deedle, ory. Well, when they saw what she had done, they tried to have her taken, but she's clapped her spurs to her horse's side, she's rode away a maiden. With me right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy, oh, with me right far lie the deedle, ory. With me right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy, oh, with me right far. Right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy, oh, with me right far lie the deedle, ory. With me right far lie the deedle, lie the doddy, oh, with me right far lie the deedle. It's a long and a dusty road, and it's a big and a heavy load, and the folks I meet aren't always kind. Some are bad, some are good, and some have done the best they could, and some have tried to ease my troubled mind. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Time. She lips like sherry wine, and I loved her till I nearly went insane. But I was too blind to see that she was drifting.
morning train. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound. If you see me passing by and you sit and you wonder why, and you wish that you were a traveler too, nail your shoes to the kitchen floor and lace them up and bar the door, and thank the world for the roof that's over you. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound, and I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound. Now I have travelled through this land, just doing the best I can, trying to find out what I was meant to do. And the people that I meet, they look as worried as can be. I guess that they are wondering too. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound, where I'm bound, where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound.